This is Anthony. You may remember me because I wrote a couple books with Aaron about Game of Thrones. You're listening to an experimental 10-episode season that we're calling Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. This is book-centric. We're going to be focused mostly on A Game of Thrones, Martin's first novel in the Ice and Fire series. Each week I'm going to talk with someone who's read this book very closely. It's probably a university professor who may have taught a class on Game of Thrones. Now, you could do one of two things with this. You could read along with us. We'll be covering the first 9 chapters. Or you could use this podcast like Cliff's Notes and experience the book without actually reading the book. If you're a show-only person, I will be having a stand-up comic friend of mine, Steve Osborne, come on every episode as he does a first watch of the HBO adaptation. I think it's going to be a lot of fun, and I hope you do too. Now let's talk about the thing that you're probably concerned about, and believe me, I know, I'd be concerned about it too if I was in your shoes. This is not an Aaron and Jim joint, which means that you're not going to hear those familiar voices every week. The unfortunate fact of the matter is, and brace yourself for it, is that Aaron, as our Game of Thrones father, said that he was going to get a pack of cigarettes and he just never came back, and Jim is snorting Westworld and freebasing the Expanse. He's just not going to be the mother that we always had hoped he was going to be. So you're stuck with me. And buddy, I'm never going to be your mom or your dad, but I could be your friend. So why don't you give this 10-episode series a chance? I'm Anthony, and this is Game of Thrones 2, Electric Boogaloo. My guest this week, in fact, my first guest, I'm really excited to have her, is Stephanie Barbe-Hammer. Stephanie is a novelist and a professor of English literature and a big fan of A Game of Thrones. Her most recent book is called The Puppet Turners of Narrow Interior. This book is great. This book is bizarre. It's funny. Stephanie focuses a lot on how to bring magical elements into a realist landscape. So she's the perfect person to talk about the prologue to A Game of Thrones. After my full interview with Stephanie, we'll get a brief excerpt of my interview with Dr. Lisa Woolfork, and we'll also be checking in with comic Steve Osborne before he's done any viewing of any episode. A brief warning. Throughout this entire series, we will welcome and relish in spoilers. Without further ado, here is Stephanie Barbe-Hammer. Stephanie, welcome. I'm so happy to have you on.
I am just thrilled to be on your podcast, Anthony. Thank you so much for inviting me.
I know that we're supposed to be talking about Game of Thrones, but I want you to know that I just finished Puppet Turners last night. On top of that, I started reading a little of, oh gosh, what's the title of your guidebook's name again?
Delicious Strangeness.
Delicious Strangeness. Delicious is the right word. So I just started reading that last night too.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So I am talking to the right person relative to imagination.
Yeah, and certainly Game of Thrones. I mean, speaking of delicious strangeness, That's a deliciously strange set of books for sure. They really are devoursome, speaking of delicious. Rereading the first one, though, I've been paging through the first book. It's not exactly an easy read. They're fairly dense books, actually.
Yes. You know, sometimes here's how I like to describe Game of Thrones to people who haven't read it. So Lord of the Rings almost builds an entire ecosystem and then like gets a microscope on one of the leaves of the oak tree.
Yeah.
Right? So the DNA of the entire system can be seen in that one little oak leaf or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whereas I feel like what Martin's doing is he's building an ecosystem one branch at a time, and he's showing us, okay, here's what's happening over here, and here's what's happening on this leaf, and then that root, and then somehow we're going to figure out how they all relate. But
yes.
He loves different branches, and sometimes he maybe
invents too many branches. And I think that that can be a problem if you ever try to finish the narrative.
Right. Yeah. In that sense, he's really, I mean, I'm going to talk about a very, very different writer, but in that sense, he's a bit like Victor Hugo, who creates these huge, huge narratives, but doesn't show us everything at once. And apparently, Victor Hugo, because it was so complicated, particularly I'm thinking about Les Misérables, that he actually forgot certain things, and there are some inconsistencies in the book. Of course, George Martin's got the, you know, the benefit of fandom, who can help him remember who's doing what to whom and where each person is in the world.
Right. So Victor Hugo didn't have the benefit of like a giant hive mind reminding
him. Right. He would have loved it too. It would have been great for him.
So Stephanie, today we're talking about the prologue of the first book in the series, simply titled Prologue. And as Martin will often do at the beginning of these books, we'll see through the eyes of a character that we either don't know or will never see again, or some character that is maybe ancillary to the overall narrative.
Yeah. Yeah, he loves to do that. He does something that's actually very typical of what procedurals and other kinds of murder mysteries do, is we see the point of view often of the quote-unquote murder victim. And that, of course, happens here in this first prologue.
That's, you know what? I never made that connection, and it totally makes sense because that's what this book is. It's a murder mystery. I mean, it's a lot of other things too, but it is a murder mystery.
Yeah, it absolutely is.
And Ned Stark is the detective, and of course, you know, we don't necessarily see the murder. If we're going to totally go that direction, we would want to find out how John Arryn died or something like that.
Right.
But clearly this book has a view to more than just what's in these pages.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to give a brief synopsis of the prologue, and then we can fill in any gaps that I missed in our conversation. Okay, so we are introduced to Martin's world, 8 or 9 days ride beyond the wall, through the eyes of Will. And Will is a member of the Night's Watch, and he's on arranging two other characters, Garrod and Sir Waymar Royce. And there's been some to-do. There's been some happening. The report back to Waymar is that the wildlings are dead and their corpses are at the encampment, and they should really start heading back because it's going to get cold, and it'll probably be colder than this lordling has ever experienced in his life. And Waymar Royce is putting on a little bit of either courage or false courage. We can talk about that. And he says, no, I'm going to look for it. I'm going to see it with my own eyes. Take me there. I have no time for cowardice. So they go to this encampment, and they find that the wildlings are gone, and this freaks out Will, and he tries to hide under a bush. And Sir Roy says, nope, no cowardice around me, please. And he sends him up a tree to scout the area. And as soon as that happens, poor Lordling Royce meets himself an other, and the other quickly kills him. And that's clearly the others are something other than human or something more than human.
What a beginning. My goodness. Yes. This introduction of these really frightening, monstrous characters who were at the same time quite beautiful. They're quite beautifully described. Yes. And here we go. We're off and running trying to figure out what's going on in this world.
Right. Okay. Let me ask you this question. So you've done a lot of work with short stories, right?
Mm-hmm.
In a sense, because these characters have a very limited run, do you think that this prologue kind of functions as a short story in the way that it's enclosed? You see the whole world enclosed in one tiny narrative?
That's a wonderful question, and I'm so grateful for this conversation because that's something that has never occurred to me. I'm actually looking at it right now, looking at the ending right now. You know, it absolutely works as a short story. My writing teachers all talk about how the end ought to tie something up, but it also should leave things open. And the ending of the prologue does that. We have this sense of who are these others, the blue eye, but we return to the idea of coldness, which is, my writing teachers have told me, you want to kind of bring things a little bit full circle. Mm-hmm. And that prologue does that, absolutely.
So I'm just going to read the last paragraph real quick here. The right eye was open. The pupil burned blue. It saw. The broken sword fell from the nerveless fingers. Will closed his eyes to pray. Long, elegant hands brushed his cheek and then tightened around his throat. They were gloved in the finest moleskin and sticky with blood, yet the touch was icy cold.
Ah! Wow. That's some good writing.
I love it. I love it. Well, okay. Now, I'm so glad you said that. All right. So it is good writing, but it's also representative of someone who isn't George R.R. Martin quite yet.
You Interesting.
Know, in other words, I guess what I mean is George R.R. Martin had written other things, and he had written for television, and I think he had some relationship to The Twilight Zone and whatnot. So he's certainly a talented author, but he's not the person he is now, right? This is him in the, I don't know, early 90s or late 80s or something like that.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And he, you know, someone that might still benefit from a writing class. And I'm curious if one of your students handed this in as a short story, what kind of comments might you give to this
Thanks.
Author?
Yeah, it's, I just looked at, it's 1996.
Okay, sure.
When the book comes out. I don't know as I would have much in the way to say about the prologue, which I think we were talking about it as a short story. I think it functions very well. It's very tight. It's very lyrical. It's also very grounded. One of the things I really appreciate about being able to revisit the prologue is it gave me the opportunity to appreciate how much we were talking about embodiment earlier, right? Mm-hmm. How embodied we get in the world thanks to Will, in particular, climbing up that tree. That moment is so important because it really, we can really feel ourselves on that tree with him. The rest of the book, I've been paging through it, kind of reminding myself of the structure. There's a lot of description. A lot. And if this, you know, if young George were in my class,
right.
I would say, you know what? What do we absolutely need to see, hear, smell? Don't tell us everything in every chapter about where we are, because it does drag the, it again, this is Victor Hugo land, because Victor Hugo did that, but this was the 19th century and there were no movies and photography was just getting going. Don't tell us everything.
Yeah, so maybe he doesn't have necessarily the same level of description as like someone like Tolkien. But getting pretty close, right?
Yeah. And of course, remember, as I'm sure you do, Tolkien was a professor. Right. And C.S. Lewis read the Tolkien books and went, oh my God, no.
So yeah, so Lewis's note to Tolkien would be similar to your note to Mr. Martin, right?
Yes, I think so.
So this is the guest choice portion of the podcast.
Yay.
Do you want to choose a character, a plot point, a theme, or do you want to climb the ladder of chaos?
The ladder of chaos. Well, I'm going to pick a theme which is a bit chaotic.
Okay.
And this is actually a question that I have for you in particular, Anthony, because you work so much on questions of religiosity and particularly your interest in Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
I'm struck by the incredibly dark world that we glimpse in the prologue. This is a dark, dangerous, cold world.
Yes.
And yet there is a person in the prologue, it's the person who we actually are most focused on, who is a person of faith.
Right. It's a prayer, right?
And he climbs up that tree
mm-hmm.
and prays to the gods of the wood. And it's, I was struck by rereading this. I thought, gosh, here it is. Here are the old gods. There's such an important idea in the entire series. And here they are just nestled into that moment. It's really wonderful writing. So there he is. He says his prayer. He prays at the end. But there is no sense in that prologue, or arguably in much of the book, of any kind of beneficent anybody in terms of the spiritual world. And I
That's right.
And what are your thoughts about that?
We just see, like so many other things in the book, we see his system of worship. We see like a wink and a nod to it. We don't really see it explained at this point yet. It's simply assumed, in other words. Right?
Right.
Here's something interesting, which I didn't think about this before, so I'm just kind of flying by the seat of my pants. If he's praying to the old gods, which it seems like he is, he's praying to the tree gods.
Right.
And he ought to be closer to those tree gods in the forest up a tree.
Absolutely.
Yet there's no help in sight.
No, there's nothing.
And it's almost like several characters we meet throughout the book will reiterate this problem, that you may believe in the tree gods, but it's very questionable about whether they ever will intervene.
Mm-hmm.
And
exactly.
It's very questionable whether or not we ever see any sort of god intervene, or if we just have a world of magic and some people interpret the magic as deity, right?
Correct. Yeah.
So the up a tree metaphor is great. The up a tree metaphor, because it's almost like he's almost climbed into the arms of a god that will not help him.
Right. Exactly. That's well put.
I love that. I mean, I love that you brought that up. So the theme, we'll eventually learn that, you know, you actually will go into a god's wood and you'll be among the trees to worship. And we're not saying necessarily that he's climbed a weirwood tree or anything like that, but trees are important in this narrative.
Absolutely. I was just struck by that reading the prologue, and then I've been reading along in this book, and then I've also been binge watching or rewatching the series, and I'm up past season 2, and the notion of faith, as you pointed out, it keeps on coming up.
Yeah.
And people dismiss it, but then it comes back up again. And so it's dismissed, but not really. Uh-huh. And rereading the prologue and thinking about Game of Thrones, and of course thinking about the moment that we're in, I find myself thinking of a very different 20th century writer who never could dismiss religion, and that is Albert Camus, the French writer.
Okay, yes, but
there's,
of course.
There's something almost sort of, and again, Camus ended up rejecting existentialism, but he was an existentialist for a time. There feels like something almost existentialist in these questions about religion and about faith and about good and evil that we see sort of circulating in the book.
Well, let me say this, and this is a point that I forget whether I make this in volume 1 or 2 of Gods of Thrones, but there are legitimate gods in this narrative that we hear and see that influence the plot. And we meet them in this chapter. They are the others. They function.
Oh, that's interesting.
Mm. Yeah, they function not like a Christian deity who's transcendent. They function much like a Norse Jotunheim or something like that. They function as sort of a monster. I mean, Greek gods, these gods are a lot like humans. They just have super duper powers, right?
Right.
And we know later on, maybe it's the end of this book, I forget where it is, but we know that Craster worships these gods.
Right.
And so these gods receive sacrifices.
That's right.
They are supernatural. They function in every way that we would expect an ancient god to function if we just started with the Egyptians or Greeks or Romans or something like
that. Right. Right. That's so interesting, Anthony. I've always loved talking to you because I always learn something. And this is a great lesson for me because I've tended to kind of write off the others and thinking about them kind of as, oh yeah, here we go again with another depiction of the zombie apocalypse. And that's one way to think about them, but you're right. It's actually much more complicated than that. And we see that, of course, as the series continues. But it's really a much more useful and productive way to think about them, to think about them as deities of some kind.
Yeah,
they're just not Judeo-Christian Muslim ones.
That's right. So if we think of them as gods in that sense, they almost are avatars for the weather in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're the gods of ice or the gods of always winter, you know?
Yes. Yeah.
To borrow Lewis's idea. But if that is the case, then they're certainly not personal. And throughout the story, they're never personalized.
No. They
almost function as this plague or this impending season or some mindless force that really doesn't care what's in its way. It's like winter's coming, and that says it all. That there's nothing you can do about winter. You can't pray to winter. It's just going to happen.
Right. It's literally a force of nature,
right.
And there's nothing that can be done with that. Mm. Right.
Okay. Notable firsts or notable introductions. We learn about the wall. We don't know exactly what it is yet.
Right.
We meet certain words like sir, spelled S-E-R.
Yes.
Unmanned and wet-nursed. We meet the word Southron.
Yes, that's an interesting one, isn't it?
So these are all words that if you're a first-time reader, these are little gateways, right? These are little stained glass windows to let in just a tiny bit of the light that Martin wants to reveal.
Yes.
And hopefully sort of set the mood.
Yeah. I'd love to say just a little something about those words, if that's okay.
Please.
That's another aspect of what Martin is doing that I really, really admire. There's a lot of futurist speculative fantasy writers do strange things with language to let us know this is a foreign world, this is a different world.
Yeah.
And I think the temptation is often to go very far in that direction. I mean, Tolkien, of course, created whole new pretend languages. But other speculative writers like Anthony Burgess, for example, in A Clockwork Orange, or an even better example is this amazing novel that's very hard going, but that is very brilliant by Russell Hoban called Ridley Walker.
Oh, haven't heard of it.
Oh, it's incredible. I really, really recommend it. However, it is written in such a strange form of English that it's very hard going to read it. At a certain point, if you can hang in for about 100 pages, you get used to it and you're fine. I've recommended it to many people who've said, I can't get through it. What's great about what Martin does is he takes something like Sir. Well, we know what's, you know, Sir Lancelot. We know what that is.
We know what it is just phonetically, right?
And he spells it differently.
Yeah.
But so we're able to still go, Sir, okay. We're able to make those leaps. And Southern, it's like, oh, that's Southern. I know what that is. They're just enough to kind of make us go, oh, we're in a different world, aren't we? But not have us go, oh, gosh, I don't understand this.
Right. Yes. We have a maester that also, like, we have some reference to Maester Aemon. All right.
Right.
And maester is spelled M-A-E.
So it's not too hard. We can go, oh, yeah, that's master.
Right.
Right. And those of us who have the pleasure of having gotten a master's degree can go, oh, yeah, he's got a master's degree in alchemy or in herbology or in astrology, all of these things, actually. Uh-huh. So yeah, I know what that is.
All right. So then something else that Martin does is he'll take something that no longer exists or a mythology that used to be popular, but not very popular anymore, and he'll reframe it. So he mentions direwolves.
Yeah.
Now, direwolves, I didn't know what that was. I mean, I didn't know that these were actual creatures.
Oh, were they? I didn't know that.
Yeah, they're an extinct form of the wolf family. They're tiny. They're not giant beasts. And I think my guess, I've never heard this confirmed, but my guess is that Martin actually got this from a Grateful Dead song.
Could be.
Because there's a reference to a hulking direwolf in a Grateful Dead song. And I think it may just be called the Direwolf. And it's in a cold setting and whatnot. But wow.
What song, Anthony? Do you remember? What song?
I think it may just be called the Direwolf.
Oh, wow. How cool.
Yeah. I mean, if someone just typed in Grateful Dead and Direwolf, they'd come up with the right answer, I'm sure. But that's something else he does. He'll take some sort of extinct creature or extinct mythology, and he'll reframe it. He'll put it in service to some other sort of mythology.
Huh. Well, and also, how great is that, that he's kind of inserted this little, you know, Easter egg, so that if you're a deadhead,
yes,
you can enter this world and go, oh, yeah, I know what that is. Awesome.
I think exactly that's right. And I think, honestly, I think that Weirwood, I think this is an homage to Bobby Weir.
Oh, could be. That's great. That's a whole other layer of kind of fun fandom points of entry for readers and viewers.
All right. So we're introduced to what I would call casual misogyny. In other words, when Jared is being derided, when he's said he's unmanned by the ideas of ghost stories he's learned at the teat of his wet nurse or something like that.
My wet nurse said the same thing, Will, Royce replied. Never believe anything you hear at a woman's tit. Right. So there you have it. It's like, okay, this is a world where women aren't worth very much.
Okay, so this brings me to a particular interest of mine. I don't write a lot on gender studies, but I tinker with it from time to time.
Yeah.
And I'm interested in looking at the relationship between Waymar Royce and Garrod from a gendered perspective. All right, so let me just give you my little brief take.
Yeah, I want to hear it.
In gender studies, there are different ways to describe masculinity. There's the ideal of masculinity, which we could think of as, you know, like Ned Stark. He's like the picture of masculinity. Right. He's wise. He doesn't talk a lot. You know, he's the strong, silent type.
Yeah, he's heterosexual, definitely.
He's heterosexual. He has a sword that he likes to play with, right? And he's strong. He's a leader. Or like Khal Drogo, he stands a head taller than everyone else. And he's never lost a battle. So if you're the ideal of masculinity in the ancient world, you don't lose battles with swords or words.
Right.
Okay.
Although they aren't big talkers, either of them.
Yes. However, if they are going to talk, they're going to win.
Yeah. They talk good, as it were. Yeah.
That's right. And sometimes they talk with their sword, and that's how they settle things. Well, that ideal of masculinity is very rare in the real world. Most of us, and I speak as one who's not the ideal of masculinity, fall into some level of subordinate masculinity. So the way that we talk about this in gender studies, we talk about hegemonic masculinity and subordinate masculinity. And hegemonic would certainly be Ned Stark.
Yeah.
And I think that this character, Waymar Royce, is trying to put on that air.
Right.
You know, he's the lord. He's got the finest clothing. He's got the bigger horse. And he's courageous. Oh, my. He's just courageous.
He's trying to be. He's really working at it as hard as he can.
Yes, that's right. He's the youngest son of a family with too many heirs, according to the text. And so he really has some kind of insecurity to compensate for.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if we think of either Will or Garrod, not quite living up to Waymar's standard of or ideal of masculinity, they're demonstrating some sort of lesser masculinity, what we might call subordinate masculinity. And that can be found when someone is feminized by someone else, right? Someone is called a woman or is said to be unmanned, right?
That's very literally.
And cowardly sort of fits into the stereotype. And here we have this downward trajectory. And you can imagine the hierarchy of importance in this society where you've got the ideal of masculinity, the hegemonic male, and then you've got various levels of subordinate masculinity, which of course, if you identify as gay or queer, that this would put you in a level of subordinate masculinity. Or if you're too fat to fight, or if you're like, poor Samwell Tarly is a great example of
yes. it. Yes.
Someone who actually admits to being a coward, this is just unheard of.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the lowest rung would be some level of feminine womanhood, right? Because that's the spectrum that we're on here
right.
for men. And so the more that Garrett and Will act like women, the less they meet the standard that, you know, someone like Ned Stark would, or Lord right. Lord Mormont would expect right. from these men.
Yeah. It sure is a struggle in the entire series, isn't it? This struggle of masculinities to a kind of assert, I'm making a gesture that you, of course, can't see. So I'm doing kind of a ladder, speaking of the ladder of chaos. These men are all struggling to be more masculine than the next one. And as I love this discussion of the hegemonic masculinity and subordinate masculinity, because it's making me realize that Sir Waymar is really terrifically foreshadowing all of these other not masculine enough men. I'm thinking about the emphasis at the in the prologue on his fancy clothes.
Yes.
And it's like, well, he's there's some comment that's great. He's like, well, he's been preparing for the night watch like crazy in terms of his wardrobe, which is like, is really a girl, you know, that's pretty girly of him. But I'm thinking about, of course, poor Theon, who is very much a Sir Aemar type, because he keeps on trying to show how brave he is, and look what happens. He's completely feminized.
Right. And Theon is so important for this particular discussion, because he's the character who, he's like the full range of it, right? He's got the potential to be the lord of a great house.
Yep, he does.
And yet, he's never going to be man enough for his father. In fact, his sister is going to be more man than he is. Right?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I think that's great. He can never exit subordinate masculinity. Although, bless his heart, he tries. He tries really hard.
He does. He absolutely
and
does.
And the other person I was thinking about with the fancy clothes and the, you know, kind of every inch a king, but not really, is, of course, Joffrey.
Right. Yes. And he's, yeah, right. Because the person who he thinks is his father is the picture of masculinity.
Yeah.
Right?
And how?
He's the king. He's the king of the realm. And he's just never going to be that type of king. And so he tries to make up for it in other ways.
Yeah, indeed.
And it comes through with, you know, ways of cruelty and specific hatred of women. I mean, talk about a misogynistic character.
Yeah. Oh, he really hates women. And he's also a complete coward. He's really afraid of everything. So he's a very kind of extreme example, as is Theon, of course, in a different way, of this problem of the near impossibility of becoming that hegemonic man.
So the only other thing that strikes me here is that if you look at these ancient Greek texts that talk about the ideal male, there is a common refrain that the ideal male, the head of a house, cares for the people under him. And so this is very different than sort of a modern view of the detached male. This kind of male in the ancient world is supposed to, you know, make good matches in matrimony.
Right.
He's supposed to make sure that there's enough food for even the least among the tribe. And so if the least are suffering, then you can question the efficacy of the king or the lord.
Right.
And this is something that Ned Stark does really well. He cares for everyone, and his children remember him really tenderly. But it's something that a lot of these men don't quite get.
Yeah, it's true. They don't. Yeah, Anthony, it makes me wonder, what do you think about this, that Martin, you know, is using this neo-medieval world, but the power structures that he's talking about aren't medieval exactly. They aren't ancient. They're more modern, you know, more capitalistic in the sense of, you know, these kings and queens, they're sort of captains of industry, and the heck with the proletariat. I mean, I think that's kind of Cersei's view, certainly. Mm-hmm. A lot of them. I mean, what do you think?
Well, I think that
it's ultimately kind of a modern concept.
I think that Martin likes hybrids.
Yeah.
And so what he'll do is, and I think he does this very effectively, he'll give us this ancient world that really borrows from these old narratives and these old histories, but he's also going to give us a character like Tyrion, or he's going to give us an entire class, an entire like scribal class called the Maesters.
Yeah.
Who are not into superstition. It's almost that they stand in for the modern perspective, almost as if this world is on the cusp of modernity.
Right.
And if we can just sort of reach a little bit closer to industry, or we can just reach a little bit closer toward the Maester's point of view, then we can put all of these superstitions and fairy tales behind us. And there's so many characters that disbelieve dragons that by the time you get to the end of this book, you're shocked that there's actual,
yes,
there's an actual
dragon. Oh my God, really? Yeah. I love your point about Martin doing this kind of hybrid writing. I think that that's a really useful way to think about the world, because as I said what I said, I thought, oh, wait, and listening to you talk about ancient literature, I was thinking, oh, wait, you know, there's all of that in ancient Greek literature, particularly the Iliad. There's all that love of men for men, which right. can be erotic, but isn't necessarily. And thinking about how the ancient Greek kind of thinking
Absolutely.
About how only men can really love other men. They can
Absolutely.
Really appreciate it. Yeah, in spots. In
yes.
spots, not in everywhere, spots. But that's really interesting, the hybrid thing, yeah.
Okay, I want to ask you three questions.
Okay.
And you can interpret these however you want and answer them however you want. Questions are something you've written, something that you've read, and something that you'd like to read.
Yeah, I can answer those. I'm actually, I've just finished a novel manuscript that I just love so much. It's the most fun I've had writing since The Puppet Turners. And it's a novel adventure story about a quite wealthy, almost 14-year-old girl from Beverly Hills who is gender not sure, orientation not sure. And the book really is a way to explore what Judaism is. Who's Jewish? Who decides? Mm. What is Judaism for us Americans in the 21st century, particularly in the forgetting horizon of the Holocaust and the complex relationship with Israel? So I'm so excited about the project. If anybody is listening to your podcast who is a publisher, talk to me, because I really want to get it out into the world.
Absolutely. So it sounds like you're playing both with sort of internal identity awareness and collective identity.
Correct.
I love it.
And it, anyway, really excited about that. And then related to this, a book that I'm reading is Ram Dass's book, not the famous one, Be Here Now, but his later one called Still Here. I was not a Ram Dass fan when he was alive. I knew the name, but I didn't know anything about him really until he died. Uh-huh. I read his obituary and went, oh, another Jewish boy. Richard Alpert is his real name. Another Jewish boy who gets interested in Buddhism and in Hinduism. He wasn't a Jew boo, but he was close.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, I guess I got to read the book, especially since I'm now 65, so I'm older. And it's a book that he started before he had a massive stroke that should have killed him.
Oh.
And that he finished after that stroke. Huh. And it's really... Well, I thought, oh, it's going to be very woo-woo. This is going to be very, you know, spiritual and new agey. And it's very, very no-nonsense and very autobiographical and humorous. I really recommend it.
Okay. And the title of that one was?
Is Still Here.
And the title of the book you're writing, if you care to disclose it.
It's Pretend Plumber.
Oh, I love it.
Because she gets fed up with her wealthy family who can't do anything and decides, I'm going to become a plumber and fix things.
Oh, I love it. I can't wait. All right. And then something that you'd like to read.
Yeah, a book that I would really like to read is a book that I've actually got sitting on my desk and I just haven't gotten to it yet. And this is Simone de Beauvoir's book on aging called The Coming of Age.
Finally, we should talk about the differences between the show and the book in this particular prologue. I noticed just a couple, but I want to know if anything struck you as unique in the writing that you didn't see on the screen.
Yeah. Oh, no, I'm happy to talk about that. And I've been thinking about that. That's been in the back of my mind, actually, as we've been talking through this podcast. Speaking of the others, when we read the prologue, I think I agree. We do get a sense that the others, there's some, the White Walkers, in other words, there's something really magical in a profound way about them.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the beauty of the descriptions.
Yeah, they're not, it's not subtle at all.
Right. They're terrifying, mm-hmm. but they're also beautiful. And the weapons that they wield are magical and, again, not human and more than human. In that prologue, there are a bunch of them that surround Will before yes. he dies. The prologue doesn't do any of that.
So I'm just a couple lines
the show,
here.
I mean, doesn't
yeah, the
do
show doesn't
that.
Do that. Just a couple lines here. The other slid forward on silent feet. In its hand was a long sword like none that Will had ever seen. No human metal had gone into the forging of that blade. It was alive with moonlight, translucent, a shard of crystal so thin that it seemed almost to vanish when seen edge on. There was a faint blue shimmer to the thing, a ghost light that played around its edges, and somehow Will knew it was sharper than any razor.
Yeah.
That's just so not human, all right? Yeah. And it's almost like Martin's hitting you over the head with it. But right. But the image of it just sliding along the snow, I have not seen that depicted. That is not a zombie. You know, we're not
right.
talking about
exactly.
This,
exactly.
Right? It's exactly. sliding. It's like sliding along the snow, just like you can kind of imagine, like if you've ever been on like a frozen lake or something, done so gracefully that you're not imagining these sort of big automatons.
Yes. When you were reading out loud, I could just close my eyes and imagine.
Yeah.
And I could really feel a sense of wonder. I mean, it's frightening, but it's amazing at the same time. And that combination of fear and wonder is, of course, the 18th century, you know, nerds tell us that's our encounter with the sublime, the thing that's just that's frightening, but that's also awe-inspiring.
Yeah.
And we don't get any of that in the TV show, in my opinion. No. At least not in this early part.
Okay, this has been so much fun.
I agree. This has just been glorious. Thank you so much, Anthony. I feel like I want to read the rest of the books now and talk with you about this some more.
Yeah, let's do that. Let's make that happen.
It's a date.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Our coverage of Hot D, Fire and Blood, and the 1980s Shogun miniseries continues. But then on Tuesday, for the first time in 35 years, we asked a question. Who framed Roger Rabbit? Hop aboard the train to Toontown as we revisit this incredible blending of live action and animation to see if it still holds up all this time later.
Then on Wednesday, we get our first look at Blake Crouch's mind-bending sci-fi series, Dark Matter. The first two episodes drop simultaneously on Apple TV Plus, and we'll have a pair of podcasts quantumly linked ready for you to observe.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
And now I talk about my favorite show with someone who doesn't care about it at all. Here's my conversation with comic Steve Osborne. To learn more about his shows in San Francisco and the Bay Area, you can look up steveosborne.com. You can follow him on Instagram at Ozfest. That's AUSFEST.
Steve, I got 7 questions for you.
Okay.
These 7 questions follow thematically 7 major archetypes that we will meet in the show. And those archetypes are father, mother, warrior, maiden, smith, crone, and stranger. So those are the themes. You know, Batman uses like a bat archetype to like scare the villains of Gotham.
Yeah.
That's kind of what happens. One of these religions in Game of Thrones uses these archetypes to keep the commoners in line. All right. So here are my questions. This is along the fatherhood theme. If you needed life advice from a father figure, you had to ask a TV sitcom dad.
Oh.
Whom would you choose?
Wow. See, I think at a younger age, I might have gone with Howard Cunningham.
Oh, all right. Yeah. Something about a cuddly dad.
Yeah, I think now maybe it's my own growing liberal sensibilities. I might go with Stephen Keaton.
Oh, yeah, maybe Family Ties, kind of older hippie vibe, right?
Right, older hippie vibe. And he's one of those older hippies who clearly has done all right for himself, like financially, right? So he's navigating a capitalist world. He's raising a kid with different ideology than him, another one that's a dummy, and another one that we forget exists. And he's doing it all relatively successfully, right? And, you know, he doesn't lose his mind if there's a goat in his house.
Yeah, I think that one works. There is,
what about you?
But I will say this. If I needed a hug from one of those two guys.
Well, you're going Bosley. I mean, you're
Cunningham. I would go
sure.
Cunningham every
yeah,
single
you
time.
Yeah, Cunningham, right?
That guy is huggable as hell.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he's just he's a Care Bear.
All right, next question. All right, motherhood. All right, so this is a little bit convoluted, so you're going to have to follow me here.
Okay.
Steve, an evil scientist has equipped you with a very fertile womb and intends to impregnate you with an other-than-human mammal.
Okay.
But you get to choose the mammal.
Okay.
What furry other would you like to mother?
Okay, well, so I have to have a furry mammal, is what you're saying? So I can't birth a dolphin, is what you're saying?
I suppose if you wanted it, the fin would make me think twice about that.
Yeah, but I just feel like the rest of it comes out pretty smooth. I'm assuming I have to raise it, right? Or am I?
It doesn't have to be furry. It could be like a hairless cat.
Is this just for the, I mean, you're asking me just for the birthing, or am I going to have to actually raise this?
Both.
Okay.
Would you like to hear the question one more time? Because it took me a long time to write it.
Sure.
An evil scientist has equipped you with a very fertile womb and intends to impregnate you with an other than human mammal. But you get to choose the mammal. What furry other would you like to mother?
For some reason, the first thing that popped into my head, and maybe that's important, was koala bear. I know they're marsupials, but that's still a mammal, right? I mean, I don't know why. Like, for when you said it, immediately it was, oh, yeah, it's koala. Like, so I kind of don't want to deny my maternal instinct.
So you, all right? I don't want to deny it either. I think it's.
I don't even have a reason for it, but I'm just going to trust myself. You know what I mean? It's like, it's one of those, you know, first thing that pops into your head. I'm like, well, it's koala bear. And I'm like, and then trying to think, and I'm like,
Is a koala bear an actual bear, or do we just call it a koala bear?
I think it's koala, but I think it's a marsupial.
Yeah. Why do we call it? Maybe that's just an American thing that we, like a teddy bear, we call it a koala bear.
Yeah. Like they may not even refer to it as a koala bear. They're just a koala.
Hmm. Next, this is a warrior-themed question.
Mm-hmm.
Who is the best non-champion Golden State Warrior?
The best non-champion.
And I'm gonna give you a caveat to make this a little more difficult.
Oh yeah,
you have to remove the Tim and Chris Berger because they won a gold medal.
Oh wow, that's a big deal.
So Timmy and Chris are out.
Might be Chris Webber.
Seriously, I'm offended just that you would even suggest it.
Why?
I mean, honestly, if I was going to build
Mitch?
Mitch Richmond, or one idea I had was Tyrone Hill, because he was kind of great once he wasn't with the Warriors anymore.
Sprewell probably is up there, I would think.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And if you need a guy choked out, he's your man. Which makes him a Warrior, by the way, in more ways than one. All right, maiden-themed question, all right?
Okay.
Steve, you're 16 again, and you've resolved to lose your virginity to a cartoon character. Which animation would you mate?
This is a touchy one, because not a ton of... Like, I'm trying to avoid an animal.
Oh, why?
Why? I mean, it's a cartoon. I don't think bestiality would apply.
Okay. Yeah, I think I'll go, I'll keep it human. I think I'll go with Velma from Scooby-Doo.
Really?
It's my first time. Chances are it's her first time. It seems like she might be appreciative. And I'll tell you what, there's something about in the throes of passion hearing the word jinkies.
This is all very revealing. Thank you very much. All right. This is a Smith-themed question, Steve. And you can write these down if you need to, all right? I want you to rank these seven Smiths by talent. Are you ready?
I am ready.
Will Smith, the rapper, actor, not the baseball player.
Mm-hmm.
Emmett Smith. Mm. Ozzie Smith. Maggie Smith. Elliot Smith. Kevin Smith. And Michael W. Smith.
Wow. And just ranking them just...
by talent.
By talent. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to go Ozzy 1.
Ooh. Is it the acrobatic moves?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I'm a sucker
in addition to being a really fantastic defensive shortstop.
I'm a sucker for a shortstop.
The floor routine on opening day, that was...
Oh, yeah.
I'm a little surprised, but keep going.
Maggie Smith.
Okay. Don't you feel like she always plays the same old lady?
She crushes it. I mean, Ozzie Smith plays the same position.
Touche.
I'm going to go with Michael W. Smith.
Oh, wow. You just blew my mind.
You know, I mean, obviously, I mean, we're talking about a guy who may have seen one note, but he had some contemporary pop hits that came out of there.
Well,
too.
Here's the thing. I don't know if I would put him on the high on the talent list. What I would say is he overachieved for having a very small amount of talent.
I don't know. I think you just described talent.
Interesting. All right.
Because of the argument that I would, and I'll put Emmett Smith next, because I would actually use, I would, the reason, yeah, I put him in this almost the same category, right? I mean, Emmett Smith maximized other people's talent to, I think, achieve the greatness that he's perceived to have. I'm not saying he's not good, but we don't know for sure, because, I mean, Arizona Cardinal Emmett Smith is sort of like, you know, you can make a lot of excuses just in terms of age, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go Will Smith.
You know, Will Smith would probably be number one for me.
Yeah.
I'm really shocked that he's so low on this list. Because, and I'll tell you why.
Okay.
Musicality probably alone isn't going to put him at the top of the list. But the fact that he then went to comedy, which, as you know, Steve, is not easy.
No.
And then became an action and dramatic star. I mean, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, you know, I think I have Will Smith erroneously lower on the list because he was the first one I wrote down, so I kind of was going through everything. But I might be a prisoner of the moment, too. Will Smith has sort of kind of, it feels like he's been mailing it in lately. But yeah, you're right. I mean, there's... I Am Legend's great.
If you get to the stage in your career where you can mail it in, that means that there's something you've done right.
Okay. All right. So Will Smith should be. And Kevin Smith is the lowest.
you missed Elliot Smith.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah, I did miss Elliot Smith. I'll put Elliot Smith right above Kevin Smith.
Not a big fan of Kevin Smith.
No. But, I don't understand it. I don't understand the Kevin Smith. I just don't get it. I could sit here. We can go back and forth and where we want to put people, but Kevin Smith is not moving up the list.
All right. Next question. This is Crone themed.
Hmm.
If you could choose to get, and by the way, this comes from my daughter. She came up with this one and I'm really proud of her for this. If you could choose to give any superpower to Angela Lansbury, what would it be?
Regeneration.
You want her to live forever?
I want her to not only live forever, but I want her to be able to go through life doing whatever she wants.
Huh.
I want her to be able to walk into a war zone without care. I want her to not have to just write about the murders. I want her to be able to just put her, like, I want, she could prevent it just by jumping in front of it, kind of thing. I mean, imagine, huh. Imagine Lansbury Unleashed.
That is just a wonderful idea for a show. Lansbury Unleashed. Wow. Last question, stranger themed. You're going to be murdered violently by a stranger. Mm. But you get to pick the nationality of the stranger. Like, what country are they from?
I'm murdered violently. So the murder is inevitable and the violence is inevitable.
Indeed.
Okay. Okay. I think I'll go Bulgarian.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Is there a reason for that?
I knew a very angry Bulgarian. And what I feel like is that the violence would be obviously painful, but like, I think it would be quicker because of so much pent up anger. So it's like, I feel like a lot of the violence will happen after I've already died. And that's seems better.
Okay. Well, I've never met a Bulgarian.
Pent up, dude. They're pent up.
To my knowledge. And so I really don't have any sort of anything to go on to confirm or deny this. But since you're the, between the two of us, you're the angry Bulgarian expert. I will allow it. Okay, Steve, you've answered all of these very, very, very well. Some of these a little bit shocking.
I'm gonna more shocking. Will Smith so low or Velma so high?
You sold me on Velma. Let's talk about your actual relationship to Game of Thrones.
Yep, got none. That's what makes it so.
No, I would beg to differ. Because
okay.
You're a living, breathing person.
Yes, this is a
so
good. So
you must have watched SNL sketches on it. You must.
I would not be eligible probably for a jury if Game of Thrones were to be accused of something. I wouldn't be able to say I have no knowledge. I would say that I would go, yeah, that's the show with, is it where it's incestual dragons? Like, that's what I would be able to describe the show.
That's actually true. The dragons are incestual.
Wow. So, I know more than I realize.
See, you know that scene in Empire Strikes Back where Luke and Leia French kiss?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, imagine a...
An entire book series written around that?
Yeah, a dirty old man decided, you know, that's the part that made everyone else feel uncomfortable. I'm just going to focus on that theme.
What if they built the entire plane out of the incest?
All right, I think we're done.
I hope that's like, that's it. I think this is pretty much sums it up. This is a pretty good way to get people on board with, hey, do you want to use this segment as something that you consider comic relief, or do you want to call this intermission?
If you'd like to follow along with Steve and I as we do our rewatch, next week we will cover episode 1, Winter is Coming. Now here's just a brief excerpt of my longer conversation with Dr. Lisa Wolfork. I will be talking with her next week about chapter 1.
This man ended up in this position because of an oath he kept.
Yeah.
In the prologue. Right?
Well, say more about that.
So, like, you know, in the prologue, you know, it's these three guys out on a ranging, mm-hmm. and Royce, Sir Waymar Royce, who is on his very first ranging. He's got this fine cloak. He's of a higher social position. He's from a rich family that had a bunch of extra boys they didn't have anything to do with. Mm-hmm. And so rather than deferring to the people that have had more experience than him, he sets off and wants to do things his way.
Mm.
And there's a passage in the prologue that said the order had been given and honor bound them to obey. And that is basically their death sentence. This 18-year-old kid who has zero experience, but a lot of social power and family wealth, tells these two people who have more experience and less wealth and less status that this is what we're going to do. They could have all lived if they had not listened to Waymar Royce.
I think that that order, if I'm tracking with you, sort of set his life on a trajectory that he had no control over.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
So following that order created a situation whereby he was going to become a deserter. And it's interesting to me that Ned doesn't just view him as a rule breaker. Ned views him as, well, he's a deserter in the sense that this tells us something about his character. Now that he's a deserter, we know that he will commit other crimes. And
that's
this is all Ned's assumption of the character of, you know, someone who's a coward or a deserter or something like that.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think that, of course, Ned's going to do that because Ned is the person who is in charge of dispensing justice and maintaining order. His job as warden of the North is to keep the North in line for the crown. Mm. And so he can't have people who are disobeying. And I guess for me, it just shows the violence. It's not just the violence of capital punishment, because of course there's a lot of violence in the series overall. It's the violence that is demanded of a feudal system where hierarchy and authority are matters of life and death. Mm-hmm. So if you know that this is not a system where people get to be represented or tell their side of the story, or you know, that really the crown is the one that has all the authority.
Yeah, unless you have a higher social currency.
Absolutely.
You're not going to demand a trial. You're just under the whims and wishes of who's ever in charge of you.
It's capriciousness. And so when you said that, you know, by obeying Waymar Royce's order, Garrett has set his life on a track beyond which he has no control. Yeah. Garrett's whole life has always been something that he has beyond his own control. Right. That's why he's at the wall in the first place.
Yes.
And the same is true for Waymar Royce, right? He's a rich guy, but he's an extra boy, and there's just not room for him to do anything. And so he gets to go, you know what I'm saying? And so this question of who has control over one's life, you know, that everybody is in these pretty tight positions that have been arrayed in advance.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
And now for this week's Bird's Eye View, the segment where I monologue for just a little bit too long.
As we step into Martin's prologue, what we're doing is, as the reader, we're stepping into Martin's world. This is his first world-building effort. And he does it by introducing three very forgettable characters. Of course, he introduces the big baddie of the entire series, the Others. The highly forgettable crows that lead off the story are Sir Waymar Royce, Will, the POV character, and Garrod. Poor, poor Garrod. They're about 8 or 9 days range north of the wall, and they're about to meet the big baddies of the series. They don't know that they're going to do this, and that's going to be a problem for them. That's probably why Martin introduces these characters, because somebody's got to get murdered. Somebody has to get got by the Others. Our way into their introduction is through these Men of the Night's Watch. The second reason I think that Martin begins with these particular characters is so he can establish the crucial social dynamic in this world, and that is the family status difference between those people with a family name like Royce and pretty much everyone else in the story. And we see this distinction on display with Waymar Royce versus these commoner companions of his, Will and Garrod. Waymar, the youngest son of a wealthy house with too many heirs, has the better horse, the warmer clothing, he's got Castleforged steel, and he's got this insufferable sense of entitlement. He's propping himself up as this great paragon of courage, and assuming that his counterparts are either not smart enough, or not courageous enough, or not well-studied enough to make decisions for themselves, or to offer good advice to their leaders. And if we think of this world as a parallel to the ancient or medieval West, Waymar demonstrates this bizarre and wrong-headed, but all too common, connection between aristocracy and military leadership. And this is the idea that the virtues of noble birth make a dude more qualified for high-ranking offices. And of course, I'm using the gender-specific language here consciously. Many ancient cultures were convinced, for a variety of reasons, that the sons of aristocrats would be better leaders, better strategists, have more courage, and something that they would call moral fortitude. This is, of course, the logical equivalent to night soil. But they believe this. In fact, there's this Greek word, aristokratia, and it's a combination of two words, aristos, meaning excellent, and kratos, meaning power. So in other words, this is a power of excellence, or excellent power. This is where we get the word aristocrat. And in Athens, there's this connection between these young men on the front line and the sons of aristocrats. So boys like Waymar were given command simply by virtue of their social placement. The Athenians really believed that wealthy, young, entitled men made the best military commanders. So Waymar seems to embody this belief. And so he sees himself as smarter than Garrod and Will. And he's, for instance, he's confidently able to read the weather better. And he can read the encampment patterns of the enemy better. And he's convinced that he's more courageous than his counterparts. So he's constantly belittling the courage of Garrod. In reality, he's more ignorant than he is courageous. But we'll return to his moment of courage in just a minute. Let's talk about the nature of courage, because clearly the Athenians were wrong. I feel pretty confident about this. I'll make my case. Here's what they thought. So if you're in this world and you're young and entitled and you're this wealthy boy raised on stories of heroism and told repeatedly that you're courageous, doesn't in a way this become your reality? Now, the ancient mindset would be you're courageous and of noble fortitude because of your bloodline. There's something intrinsic in your bloodline that makes you more noble. But sociologically speaking, if someone tells you you're courageous over and over and over, couldn't this sort of become your reality? If society expects you to be more virtuous or better equipped for battle simply because of your lineage, you might want to lean into this. Isn't this the sort of perception that creates reality? Now, as we'll see with Sam Tarly later in the story, the answer is not necessarily, but almost all of the other entitled brats that we meet in this book end up believing what the Athenians believed, that being that one's bloodline is fundamental to one's talent as a military commander. So Waymar is just the beneficiary of his social placement. There's another key difference between Waymar and his crow companions, and I think that is probably explained with educational opportunity and wealth. If you grow up not having to plow or seed or pick or package or whatever else you do as a peasant for 10 hours a day, you have more time for martial training. And if you have the best armor and steel, you'll probably have the advantage in battle. And with a little bit of luck, you'll find yourself in a situation where this whole aristocratia myth is reinforced. And eventually Waymar, because he thinks he knows better, ignores the advice of his brothers and leads them into the encampment of the wildlings. According to Will, who scouted the place already, the camp is only populated by corpses. So Will freaks out and takes cover under a bush when he sees that the corpses have vanished. Waymar doesn't know he's in a zombie story yet, so he's not impressed by the fact that the dead wildlings are gone. So he sends poor Will up into a tree to get a better look around. Will wants to hide under a bush, but he has to go up a tree. And that is when Sir Waymar's courage is finally required. If you are a commoner, even if you're older, even if you know better, even if you're wiser, even if you're better naturally at command, when this little lordling on his first ranging, if he's in command, if he tells you to go into the haunted forest to your own death, you do it. Because that's just the social fabric of the world that Martin's creating. And it was the social fabric of a lot of the medieval and ancient period. And in many places in the world, people still have this mentality. And even in the modern West, some people confuse natural talent with social placement. Another thing about courage. Waymar lacks a bit of crucial intelligence about his enemy. What Waymar doesn't know about the others is that they exist. He doesn't know that they exist. Garrett suspects them, and Will's smart enough to fear the possibility of something haunted, smart enough to heed his feelings. Waymar is simply ignorant, and his ignorance overlaps his courage. He stupidly forces an encounter with the others and ends up dead. Now, sometimes courage is just stupidity. And that's probably the case with Waymar. He's probably just stupid. But sometimes stupidity and courage run parallel. All right. So I'm going to nuance the point just a little bit here. It is possible to convince yourself through stupidity that you are courageous. Once convinced, you can act in ways that might be construed as courageous. I think Waymar is doing something similar here. He's got no idea what he's about to encounter. And because of his stupidity, he's going to put himself into an episode that requires courage. And then I do think he does exhibit some courage in the end. Waymar finally faces the other, and Will is looking down from the tree. And from his hidden position in the tree, he notices that Waymar dies with courage. In those final moments, observes Will, Waymar is truly a man of the Night's Watch. So he's grown up in that moment, the last moments of his life, because he exhibits a certain amount of bravery. So Will, it seems, measures courage differently than Waymar. For Will, courage is earned and inherited. Now finally, for all of those egalitarian aspirations of the Night's Watch, isn't it highly possible, maybe even likely, that Lord Commander Mormont harbors some of these same wrong-headed views on command? Why is he grooming Jon Snow so early for command?
Is it because he's bought into this idea that the son of Ned Stark, bastard or not, is going to make a better leader in the long run? Just by virtue of his blood. And you can see why so many men of the Night's Watch just hate Jon from the very beginning. When Mormont is giving rich, young, entitled pricks like Waymar Royce command way too early, you might come to resent rich kids like Jon Snow. So I love this prologue because it teaches us the first and maybe the most important social dynamic of this world. The civic gap between aristocracy and commoners is the dark heart of several dysfunctional relationships in the story. Think of the fault lines between Jon and the free folk, or between Tyrion and his first wife, Tysha, or the fault line between Dany and Miri Mazdoor, or between Roose Bolton and his bastard son, Ramsay Snow, or the fault lines between Joffrey and the butcher's boy, Micah, or between Bran and Hodor. The power asymmetry in these relationships dooms these relationships from the very beginning. And sometimes the best intentions of our favorite characters are spoiled because of these intrinsic power dynamics. Waymar is just the first of many to misconstrue and misuse his social advantage and end up dead because of it.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on the series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. Next time on Electric Boogaloo.
How do you feel about, like, do little monster kids do anything for you? Like, I think that that's a pretty typical horror trope, is to have one of the monsters look like a little kid.
I think before I had children, I think it would have freaked me out more. The worst thing that that little monster child would do is tell me about the dream it just had. Good Lord, go back to bed.